Dear Ajahn, I think Mara, remember Mara we were talking about later on? That was the one who tempts you, controls you, the bad guy of Buddhism. I think Mara is living in my cottage. Quite likely. Is it okay to break the noble silence and say to her? I know you, Mara. Yeah, go for it. Do arahats have likes and dislikes, e.g. food taste, smells, heart flaws, beds, etc.? There's a great story of the Buddha, who's obviously an arahat, and there was this guy, this monster, Suchiloma the Yaka. Suchiloma means like needle hair. So it was the first little punks. You know those punks that had these needle hairs? So that was passe. Buddhism had that a long time ago. So he was this demon, this yaka with needle hair. And the Buddha was meditating on this rock in a place called Gaya Caesar. And this Suchiloma, the yaka, decided to test out to see if this really was a Buddha, an enlightened being or not. So he sat next to him. So there was a Buddha, and there was this guy with his needle hair. And this needle hair guy, he leant over to the Buddha. And the Buddha leant away. Aha! You're not a real arahat. You're afraid of being spiked by me. And the Buddha said, no, look, an arahat also has wisdom as well. So, you know, you don't sort of go and sort of step on snakes. You don't just run through fires. So even an arahat, they look after their body out of compassion for all sentient beings. And that really sort of started me to think, you know, this idea of being an arahat. Sometimes if you're not, you know, not an arahat, you're a long way away, you get some weird ideas of what an arahat must be. One of the other stories I really, really liked, it gave me a lot of encouragement when I was a young monk in Thailand, especially during the hot season. Because apparently Mara was following the Buddha around, trying to prove he wasn't fully enlightened. And one day, during the hot season, the Buddha laid down to have a snooze after lunch. And Mara was following, ha ha, caught you out. You're just a lazy bum sleeping in the afternoon while other people are working hard. These are the people who are feeding you and you just lay down. What do you do that for? And the Buddha replied, I'm having a rest for the benefit of all sentient beings. And I thought, that's a really good excuse. So every time I had a sleep in the afternoon, it wasn't indulgence, it was this is for the benefit of all sentient beings. But then I really thought, actually, that maybe there was something more to that. It wasn't just a sort of an excuse. Basically, it was because that the Buddha was looking after his body for the sake that he could teach other people, live a long life. So the way you look after your body as a wise person is not with attachment, but also not with negligence as well. So in the same way that if somebody loans you their car, you try and make sure that, you know, the battery is always kept well so that it doesn't run out, it doesn't get scratched, because it's loaned to you. So you look after it without being attached to it. In the same way, that's what you should do with the body, to look after it without being attached to it. And that's a fine line there. But obviously, if the yucca leans against you, you can lean away. You don't have to say, I'm an arahat, I should just endure this. So that's actually the answer there. They do, not so much likes and dislikes, but compassion for their body, compassion for others. Because that's what I really thought. Because, you know, being a Westerner, you try to, you know, think, and, you know, what is it like? And arahats go, no likes at all, no desires. And so imagine what it would be like, you know, if you had no likes, no desires at all. Totally equanimous. Didn't care what happens. It means whenever you felt like urinating, you just urinate right there. No preferences. Please don't do that. So obviously the arahat has a desire to go to the toilet and walks to the toilet and sits down. And he has the desire to, you know, push the button afterwards so it flushes down. So when you actually start to have a bit more common sense, you understand, yes, the cravings of an arahat have gone, but the compassion, what motivates the arahat is the four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, know, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That's what motivates. And that's the only reason why they keep living. For the sake of the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. And for that, you don't shit right where you're sitting here, because that's not compassionate for the people who have to sit next to you and look after you. And look after the floor. So, obviously, you just go to the toilet. So you do have desires and dislikes in that one sense. And it's the desire for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. Nothing personal anymore. In mindfulness, bliss and beyond, you say that meditation at the higher levels causes you to let go of sex. Does this mean that if you have a partner, you shouldn't go too deep, otherwise you might have to get a divorce? No, get the divorce. Look, I mean, you've got the choice there. You've got the bliss of jhanas, or just, you know, being stuck, you know, with your partner for the rest of your life. Oh, God. They say that in life you have two choices. The two choices of life. Number one, remain single and be miserable, or get married and wish you were dead. Why are you laughing at that? You know, I told that joke at Nolamau a couple of weeks ago, and the guy I told it to, he was stony faced. He usually likes my jokes, and I only found out afterwards he's getting married in 4 weeks' time. That was really a big mistake. My job involves arts and entertainment. Any advice how not to get involved in the five senses and keep inclining towards nirvana while still earning money in the five senses? My job involves entertainment as well. It does. So I entertain you every evening. So like, it's entertainment is good in a sense that, you know, you are actually, if it's really done for the right reason, because sometimes people are very miserable, and sometimes they're really depressed, and sometimes, you know, livening them up, you know, being fun, telling a joke, especially a lot of reasons why jokes are funny. It's because they're actually real. You're laughing at yourself. You're laughing at life. You're laughing at marriage. You're laughing at the state of our existence. That's why many of the jokes are actually very profound. And that's actually why they're funny and they make a lot of sense. So, you know, telling a joke is fine. And, you know, many of the monks, Ajahn Chah, used to tell jokes. And this one monk, his name was Ajahn Singh Tong. He was an incredibly funny monk. You know, you've seen us give the chanting just after the dana. Now, when I first went to meet this Ajahn Singh Tong, he was one of the disciples of Ajahn Mun. He's a great monk. Unfortunately, he died in a plane crash, but you know, he has such a great sense of humor. And when he did the chanting, I'm going to imitate it for you now. This is how he did the chanting in the morning. He'd start, Yata Vari Vaha Pura Pari Purenti Sagarang Ewa mewa ito dinang, petanang upakapati, ichitang patitang tumhang, kipa mewa samijatu, sabe burentusangapa. He was a bundle of laughs. And I couldn't actually, first of all, I thought this was crazy, but he was a very, very wise monk. And he did that because, you know, it actually drew disciples to him. And then, you know, as the I heard from a Tibetan monk, is that when people are laughing, when they've got their mouth open, that's when you put the pill of Dhamma in. In other words, they're listening to you, and then actually you can teach them. So how not to get involved in the five senses is remember that you just know you're doing this out of compassion for other beings. And as arts, you're, you know, teaching them the truth of the nature of things. And arts can actually do that. It could convey sort of the Dhamma in a beautiful way. So if you're doing it with a good purpose, it's not to try and excite people with, you know, sex or violence, but, you know, some good stuff, then okay. And if you want to have an example of that, I've already shown people that it was a project done by this person in art school in Budapest. He had to do a project, and what he did, he was listening to my talks on the YouTube, and I mentioned about Super Monk. And you've heard me say that before in talks about Super Monk. So he did this comic, the Super Monk comic. No action comics. And it's an action comics. And it's going around, and a few of you had a look at it already, so have a look at that. So that's entertainment. It's a comic strip, and it's very artistic. But it's also got this incredible nice drama inside. You know, for example, just, you know, the crook in the end, they finally catch him. But the police said, oh, Super Monk said, let go. So we freed him. We've got all those sort of stories like that. It's beautiful. So that's the way you can actually combine arts and entertainment and dumb at the same time. So have a look at it. It's around somewhere. Could you please explain how to resolve spiritual competition in the following among individual Buddhist practitioners and Buddhists? Amongst Buddhist organizations, different Buddhist traditions. Yeah, there's all this competition. Who's going to get enlightened quickest? Actually, no. So what was it last New Year's Eve? Every New Year's Eve, you know, I hold a party at our center in town. A New Year's Eve party. Ajahn Brahm's New Year's Eve party. And I've been doing that for years. Because, you know, ordinary Buddhist people, it's New Year's Eve, and the tradition over in Australia is to go out for a party. So they go to a party, and they sometimes say, well, you've got much choice, and everyone else is drinking, and they say, come on, and they sort of get me to have some alcohol, and I get into trouble. So I said, okay, we'll have a party in our centre in Nolamara, but it'll be a Buddhist party. So I always actually do something to have a bit of, you know, obviously no alcohol, just lots of orange juice, cups of tea. But, you know, I do something to make it a little bit more light, but have some Dharma content as well. So the last time it was the five indriyas. And the five indriyas, you know what the five indriyas is? It's that it's sadha, faith, and it's energy, and mindfulness, stillness, samadhi, and wisdom. So, okay, let's have a competition. So I divided people into groups, and the first one was faith. And I said, okay, I'm your teacher, so who's going to say the nicest expression of faith in me? And of course I judge it. Really good fun. I always say, if you're humble, I'm a very humble monk, if you're a humble monk, flaunt it. And the next one was energy. I said, okay, the chant, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Who can do it with the most energy? And the group which actually did it and won, they did it, you know, if any of you have seen New Zealand rugby, you know, they do the haiku, the haka, and they did Namo Tassa. It was really good. They were just making it interesting. And as for mindfulness, we did the slow walking. And I had, like, people from each group, there was about seven of them, and I had to do slow walking. I had the monks, they were checking, they had to move. They couldn't stay still. And if they actually paused and stood still, they got eliminated. They had to move, but slowly. And the one who actually walked the slowest would win that particular part. And then there was samadhi, so they had representatives sitting meditation, and there was lots of kids there. I said, okay, kids, try and disturb them. You know, be like Mara. So the kids were great because they were playing around. No, they couldn't touch anybody, but they could actually whisper in their ear and do all sorts of stuff and try and make them laugh and try and disturb them. And the last one was wisdom. I say, who's going to say the most profound thing? So they had to say something profound. And that way it was like entertainment. They had a good time. But it's also, they were learning what the five indriyas were. So they could never forget them after that, I hope. But that was competition in a sort of a fun way. But amongst individual Buddhists, again, the competition should be who's the most humble, who can disappear first, who has the less attainments. So afterwards you say, how did you do? And you say, I got nothing, I got nowhere. I did much worse than that. And see who does the worst. Then they're the best Buddhists. They're the most humble. They're the ones who are most empty. All these people who say, I've got first, that's nothing. I've got second, that's nothing. I got that last year. I got third jhana. I got Srivana. I got Arahat. I got super Arahat. I got mega Arahat. Now, of course, that's got nothing to do with Buddhism. So after a while you realize, you know, what we're trying to do here is, in Buddhism, is supposed to overcome conceit. And in Buddhism, this is serious now, three conceits. And when I read this first of all, it was brilliant stuff. The three conceits that I am better. Yeah, I knew that one. That was conceit. I am worse is also a form of conceit. So if you think you're worse than everybody else, that too is conceited. If you think I'm the same as everybody else, that is the third conceit. Both of them are delusion. You are not better. You are not worse. You're not the same. You're just different, that's all. We're all different. I'm right, as you remember that one. That was from The Life of Brian, if anyone saw The Life of Brian movie. They asked Brian to say something profound, and he said, "You're all different," and somebody put their hand up in the crowd, "I'm not." He was the only one who said that though, so he really was different. And amongst Buddhist organisations, again, we don't compete with each other, which is the best monastery. We try and work with one another. Because, you know, there's too much sort of competition and too much sects. What sects actually means is cutting off, it's sectioning one people, one group from another. And different Buddhist traditions. That one thing which I learnt, you know, from the bhikkhuni ordination, that there's no such thing as Mahayana bhikkhunis, or Theravada bhikkhunis, or Vajrayana bhikkhunis. They're just bhikkhunis who happen to follow Mahayana, who happen to follow Theravada, who happen to follow Vajrayana, but they're bhikkhunis first of all. That was the reason why I thought you don't need Theravada bhikkhunis to start the Theravada bhikkhuni lineage. Any bhikkhuni would do from any tradition because they're bhikkhunis. First of all, and all this sex business about being Mahayana, Theravada, Thai, Vietnamese, Zen or whatever, that has no foundation in the Vinaya. Because the Vinaya is actually the same. If you've had your ordination, and it comes back from the, goes eventually back to the Buddha, you're a bhikkhu, you're a bhikkhuni, and that's it. And all these different sects, which we have, just came much later, they've got no real foundation, yeah, in the law of the constitutional law of Buddhism. So, you know, if you wanted to become a Mahayana bhikkhuni, you don't need to sort of reordain, you just change your clothes. If I wanted to become a Vajrayana monk, I wouldn't need to sort of reordain, you just wear Tibetan robes, that's all. Because you're a bhikkhu, you're a monk. Once I really got that into my head, that all this sects business has just no real foundation, it was wonderful because it meant there was no difference between any monk, no matter what part of the Buddhist world they were ordained into, Korea, Sri Lanka, sort of Vietnam, Mahayana monks, they're my brothers. You know, I really feel that. You go, because I travel around a lot, as many of you know, I do stay in other people's temples. And you know, these are the same as the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. They may wear, you know, Chinese Mahayana robes or Vajrayana robes, but you feel these are the same as me. It's wonderful, at last in Buddhism, we can get rid of all this Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana nonsense. It's just Buddhist. And that's wonderful. We can have this harmony. And it's so easy to do because the legal foundation of this sect is just not there. So I think there's no different Buddhist traditions. So, and I'm not just saying that because I'm idealistic. There's a legal foundation for that. If ever you study the Vinaya and really get your head around it and get into it, there's no reason for any sort of sects. They can come together immediately. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between luck, right timing, and right conditioning? There's probably a joke in this somewhere. between luck, okay, it was actually that there is such a thing as luck. It's, well, maybe just mention this important story. There was, because sometimes people say, is it always conditioning, is it always karma that these things happen to you? And the story which changed the way I looked at the law of karma was, again, from Ajahn Chah, because there was one of his disciples was drafted into the Thai army And on the borders, even though there's no real wars, there's always skirmishes, you know, between the Laotian communists or the Cambodians or the Burmese. A lot of it's not reported, but he got wounded in a skirmish. And he was wounded quite badly. And so, you know, he had to leave the Thai army. And when he went to see Ajahn Chah, he asked the question, why did this happen? Why did I get wounded? You know, is it karma? Did I do something bad in the past? Why? And Ajahn Chah said, you got shot. The karmic reason for being shot was joining the army. That's what happens when you join the army. Some people get shot. Now that's common sense. He said, not everybody gets shot. And he said, like, why do you die in a tsunami or a flood or an earthquake? Because you've been born as a human being. If you read the contract, what I call the fine print, you'd have read before you were born that you're liable to die from any such reason. That's par for the course. So the karma of being born is to die from so many various causes. Which one actually happens is maybe luck. But the fact that you're subject to each one of these is karma. Anyway, how are the monks and nuns named chosen and by whom? Do the names mean anything? Yes, you all know what Brahm means. B for Buddhist, R for Roman Catholic, A for Anglican, H for Hindu, and M for Muslim. That's Brahm. You know, often that, you know, because I use a telephone, sometimes, you know, you have to give your name and spell your name over the phone. Most people laugh. But every now and again, you get these people, I'm afraid to say it's usually women, who afterwards they go quiet. They just don't have sense of humour, some of these people who answer the telephone. I don't know why. So anyway, that's what that is. Now, people choose their names from different ways, different means. And in Bodhinyana Monastery, when somebody ordains, before they ordain, I ask them to choose their own name. Because they've got to live with their name. If they get a bad name, it's going to be very difficult. So, they choose their name. And I like to ask them to look in these books, the Theragata, which is the verses of these enlightened monks in the time of the Buddha. Actually, to read those, when you find some verses which is very, very inspiring, then choose that name. So that's what I love to do. But sometimes the monks like other names. So they just, you know, choose whatever names. And interestingly, that, you know, we use those names as Westerners, you know, we call it, you know, Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Venerable Sanghamaji and Vedananda. But in many countries, especially in Thailand, they still use the lay name. They would call me like Peter Brahmawangsa. But we don't like using that because we want to sort of try and make a complete distinction between your lay life and your monastic life. But because of that, they had these lay names used in Thailand. I came across this one monk years and years ago. And you know what his first name was? His first name was, the Thais will understand this, was Kimar. Was dog shit. That was his name. And I couldn't understand. What parent would call their son dog shit? But that was his real name. It was on his birth certificate. And the story behind this was really interesting. This is what happens with superstition. Because in this particular village, this was maybe almost 30 years ago now, in this village, so many mothers were having stillborn children. So, you know, the pregnancy wasn't coming to fruition and the babies were born dead. And so they had a whole meeting of the village and say, what's going on? They didn't have doctors in these days in the village. So they said, what's going on? They said, it must be one of these demons, one of these yakas, is around the village getting our babies. That's why they're dying. That was a superstition. There was a goblin. And so they said, how can we keep this goblin away? So they had this brilliant idea. This is what happens when you get a lot of men trying to figure out good ideas. They said, for the next couple of years, every baby born in this village will have a disgusting name. Because then Any self-respected goblin would never go near anyone called dog shit or cat vomit or something else. So all these kids, all these boys and girls had these disgusting names for a couple of years. And this poor guy, you know, he was born at that time, and so he was dog shit for the rest of his life. That was his name. Imagine that. That's really crazy. So it's interesting. You see what happens when you have superstition. Ajahn, what is the... Oh, I didn't actually say there's one at the end here. Why isn't His Holiness the Dalai Lama vegetarian? Shouldn't he be? I think one of the reasons is because, like in places like Tibet, just like in the northeast Thailand, there wasn't vegetables. Now imagine, look, you know, if you ever go to Tibet, it's in the mountains. And, you know, most of the year it's snowing, or it's covered with snow. And if there is any arable land, it's usually used for, was it barley they grow up there? They're just getting vegetables, they just haven't got the land for it. So because of that, it's just impractical. So I think that's probably why. But these days, of course, he can get whatever he wants. So I don't know, you might be asking. Ajahn, what is a good life in retirement for a lay person? Thank you. A good life in retirement is hang around the monastery, do lots and lots of work, look after the monks and the nuns. Because look, if you get in retirement, people always say this, when you retire, you have to work harder than when you're at work. They always get to do things. You know, your wife asks you to do things. Your kids ask you to babysit and all that sort of stuff. So if you want a bit of peace and quiet, hang out around the monastery. That's the best place. So if you're going to work, we could exploit you rather than your wife. So hang around the monastery. And it's also because actually you hang around peaceful people and kind people. You learn a lot. A lot of times, you know, you learn most from osmosis. Just hanging around good people, and then you become a good person. So if in your retirement, just hang around sort of, you know, the monasteries. That's much better than hanging around the pub. In a lengthy sitting, I find it necessary to put effort to keep the breath meditation object alive. Your comments, please. I think that's when the breath meditation is becoming very, very soft. And sometimes the mindfulness isn't strong enough to keep up with the subtle breath. So instead of putting effort in to keep up with the breath, try putting joy in. Appreciate the breath. One interesting, skillful means of doing this. You're meditating a long sit, and you can feel the breath, but it's sort of dull, and it's not doing very much. Take your attention away from your breathing, just for a second or two. Put it on your face, and smile. Now actually it's a very powerful technique, because when you smile, your mind is looking at happiness and joy. Because that's what happens when you smile, it actually brings up a happy, joyful mind. And then you go back to the breath, and the breath is happy and joyful. And then it brightens up. And it's easier to actually to watch that breath, and by cultivating the joy, the breath gets more and more joyful, you get the delightful breath. And that's all you need to do, just to take your attention away. Smile, and you can feel the joy, transfer it onto the breath, which is easy to do, and then you have a wonderful time with the breath. Very simple technique, but it really works. Once in a blue moon, I feel like my body is rising up. Is this possible, or just weird perception? Or just ask the person sitting next to you to find out. Maybe just put something a little bit above your head and see if you bump into it. Give yourself a test. No, it's always just, it feels that way. It brings me to an interesting point in meditation. Somebody already mentioned this in their interviews. There's experiences in meditation which I call your perception gaining its wings. That's just the way I put it. Because what happens is your perception, the way you see things, the way you're experiencing things, is so limited by conditioning. Basically, you're not allowed to see weird things. And what happens when you meditate? Those blinkers on perception, those limits are removed. And you can start to see things in a weird way. And one of the first times this happened to me, over in Thailand, one day I was having some great meditation, and I passed what was the washing place. I had a well in the place where the monks would wash. And there was a line there with the towels, you know, drying in the line. And I stopped because one of the towels was jet black. And I'd never seen a black towel before. You know, red towels, pink towels, yellow towels, white towels. But no shop ever sells a black towel. And so I stopped, you know, rubbed my eyes and looked. That's a black towel. What's that doing there? And for about 2 minutes, I stared at that towel. And then it changed back to white again. And I thought, wow, this is weird. Now, one of the things, you know, because I was a scientist before, I was never afraid of these experiences. I just think, well, what's going on there? And of course, actually, you started reading in the suttas, you know, there's some, you get into some sort of states of mind where it feels like it's midday during the middle of the night, or in the middle of the night, it's like daytime. It's just what you're doing is playing around with your perceptions. And that was actually the first of several really weird experiences. Sometimes you can look at a wall, and if you can really play with your perception and let it fly, just the wall starts to melt like chocolate on a hot day. It's weird. And sometimes when you're meditating, many of you may have the experience of you expanding, really ballooning out, you know, filling half the hall, or just sinking into the ground or rising into the air or whatever. You know, that's not uncommon. And all it is this perception, part of your mind, it's been so limited that now it's free and it plays. And it gives you all sorts of different ways of looking at things. What it actually teaches you, if you reflect upon it, the insight which you get from that, is just how you experience the world is so narrow. You're only allowed by the conditioning of your culture to see things in one way. And now, those limits are removed, and you can see things in weird ways. It's good fun. It only lasts for a few minutes, and then you come back to normal again. It's just like, you know, seeing a movie with special effects. You know, it can be quite boring in meditation retreats, day after day after day. So when you get some weird stuff, ah, this is cool. Some entertainment. So go for it. Can one be meditating during sleep? Yeah. I actually told someone, the nuns earlier on, the bhikkhunis, about sort of meditating during sleep, and that's really cool. But you know, usually what happens, you'll be meditating before, I get some great meditations, and then when you meditate, when you're sleepy, you know, you meditate again, and the mind actually takes off again. But usually what happens, especially if you get nimittas, you usually wake up. Because I remember that, look, this is actually one time, I remember having this dream of, you know, walking. It was actually with, you know, the old monk Ajahn Yanadamo. We were walking together. We had all these shrines of these great monks in Thailand, and we were just, wow, there's a great monk shrine here, great monk shrine there. And I already mentioned one of the monks I really, really respected was this Ajahn Tate. And I came to his shrine, and maybe because I respected him, he saw the sort of the name there, and this beautiful nimitta came out. It exploded. There's so much bliss. And that was in the dream, and that was the end of the sleep. You're just wide awake after that, and you have to meditate, even if it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. So if you really get some meditation, some strong meditation in your dream, it wakes you up. But you don't mind, you're having fun. Who wants to sleep when you get nimittas? So yeah, you can, but be careful, it wakes you up. During sleep, when the body awakes and knows there is no consciousness or soul, it is somewhere else. What is that all about? Ah, no. If it knows that there's no consciousness or soul, there is a consciousness, so it's still there. What is that all about? I think that you're a bit confused. So just don't even think about that. Get up, have a cup of coffee, and then you'll be fine. Get your head together, because sometimes after sleep you're not very clear. Thank you, Ajahn, for your instructions and provided such a wonderful place for mental culture. Thank you so very much. Yeah, you know, I deserve that. That is one of the famous teachings. That some years ago, why is it that no one accepts praise? What most monks would say is, oh, yes, okay. They would never receive praise. And that's why people always get depressed. Criticism, yeah. Terrible jokes again. Why do you keep telling the same jokes? Yeah, that's right. I feel terrible. But people receive criticism, but they don't receive praise. And that's not a very skillful way of living your life.
Some years ago, I received this medal from John Curtin, from Curtin University. It was a John Curtin medal. And it was a prestigious award. I had to give a speech in front of all the dignitaries. And my speech was, it was actually for community service, vision and leadership for the Buddhist community. And so when I gave my speech, I said, look, I don't really know why you gave this to me. There's so many other people in the community doing much, much more work than I've done. And anyway, I couldn't have done this without all the people sort of who helping me. So I don't really deserve it myself, but thanks anyway. That was the basics of my speech. Next year I went to someone else's medal ceremony, and they were a very inspiring person. They'd done a great work. And I thought, wow, this person really deserves their medal. And when they came up to the microphone to give their acceptance speech, they said, I don't know why you gave this to me. There are many other people in the community who do much more work, and I couldn't have done this without all the other people assisting me. And I recognised that was my speech from last year. And everyone gives the same speech. And because I was now sitting in the audience, I started to reflect. Well, that guy really deserved his medal. And there was a panel of very intelligent people who had done their research, and they had decided that this guy deserved a medal. And I agreed with them when I heard what he'd done. And so I started to think, hey, did I deserve my medal? And for the first time, I accepted it. I accepted the praise. Yeah, these were very wise people, intelligent people, who sat down and had many, many candidates, and they decided that I deserved it that year. And by saying I don't deserve it, I was actually rejecting those people in the panel. I was saying, you're stupid, you got it wrong. Which was very disrespectful to them. Why do you do that? What's wrong with accepting praise? The reason is because I was told when I was a kid, if you accept praise, you'll get a big head. But I found in life, you don't get a big head, you get a big heart. And a big tummy as well. But especially you get a big heart. So when somebody praises you and says, Dania, thank you so much for looking after this place and caretaking. Bianca, incredible amount which you do for us. Thank you so much. If they say that to you, say, thank you, yes, I deserve it. Please receive it. And you'll have a much bigger heart and a happier person. Better meditation, everything else. Ajahn, what do you think about Islam? Not all that much. I don't think much about other religions. I have read that the Quran has been written exactly as per God's instructions and never been written or edited again. So what do you think about this fact? You don't know, you have to ask God. Because that's what people say. And that's the problem is, and that's what people say. Who knows? Now the chances are, because that's... Now that's ancient, and things have changed since then. That's the problem, that we all say that we've got the truth, and ours is the only way, and that is the problem. That doesn't sound like truth to me. What sounds like truth to me is just general principles, and principles of like kindness, compassion, letting be. There's like truth has a certain taste to it, a certain smell, if you like. And a truth which is violent is no truth at all. A truth which separates believers from unbelievers, that's not a truth. A truth which says that our people will be punished and others rewarded, that's not a truth. And all the things you've heard here, have I talked about punishment? Have I talked about separating one person from another person? Did the Buddha ever teach like that? That's why when I read Buddhism, it's got the smell of truth to it. Of harmony, of peace, of respect. No punishment, no violence. No controlling, no fear. But even like lovely things like accepting praise. Feeling good about oneself. That's got the smell of truth. But you make your choice. Can you please explain the connection between Zen teachings, yoga and Buddhist meditation? Oh God, that's a hard one. Zen teachings, yoga and Buddhist meditation. Like what the Zen teach? Okay, one of the great Zen teachings. Because, first of all, this, when I was a young monk, a young Buddhist, like I learnt my Buddhism in England. There's hardly any monks or Buddhist centres in those days, 1969, 70 or whatever, when I started becoming a Buddhist. So I go to any teacher, anything which remotely sounded like Buddhism, I'd go there because I was so hungry. So I remember going to the Thai temple and there was a Zen monk was visiting. And you know, the Thai temple would invite Zen monks because, and again, they knew there was very few teachers around. So the Zen monk came and gave a talk and it was hopeless. He couldn't speak any English. But he still went along. But then after his tour, he's a smart guy, so when he came back to give another talk about 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, he could actually learn some English. Because someone asked him a question. And the question was, you know, you've been in England for about 3 or 4 weeks. What do you think about Buddhism in England? And he replied in English to the question, what he thought of Buddhism in England. He said, books, 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 too many, too many, too many, dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. Now that was just so wonderful. Right to the point. Because that's what it was like in those days. I had all these armchair Buddhists discussing the highest teachings around a coffee table and then going to the pub and getting drunk afterwards. You know, it's just all in the head. So that's essentially yoga. Yoga is like, well, there's all types of yoga. I mean, there's the Raja Yoga, where they do lots of meditation. But the Raja Yoga, they believe in an eternal self. And Buddhist meditation. Buddhist meditation just destroys everything. We are the big destroyers. But, as I said in one of the introduction to my latest book, which isn't, now some of you got it, I said, Buddhists, all those three traditions, Zen, Yoga, and Buddhist, we are the biggest losers. You know that TV program? There's a TV program called The Biggest Loser. We're the biggest losers because we abandon everything until there's nothing left. No body, no will, nothing, all gone. So no one can be a bigger loser than an arahat. So, losers we are. So you're a loser, I'm a loser. It's fun being a loser. You have less things to worry about. Why do monks and nuns not eat after midday? Oh, look. I only eat in the morning. Look how fat I am. I'd die if I had to eat in the afternoon or evening. Can't give me a break. Could you comment on the flower sermon of the Buddha, which was understood by Mahakashyapa? No, it was not. That came a long time after the Buddha. That was one of these things which were added afterwards. It's not original to the teachings of the Buddha. Because what we have, you know, we have the Pali Tripitaka, we also have the Chinese Agamas. And actually they come from a common source. And that's like the earliest Buddhism. We can find out what was early, what was late. And one of the ways of finding that out, as I told someone in interviews, is actually look at the way these things are written. For example, if I got out a copy of like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which was written what, about 16th century or 17th century or something, and then I got out some Shakespeare, and then I got out some Harry Potter, and read it out, would you be able to tell which was early, which was late? Could you figure out that Harry Potter was not written in the 16th century? Of course you would, because language changes. The vocabulary changes. You know, the way we put words together changes. And because of that, you can actually work out when something was written pretty accurately. That was developed by the scholars of the Christian Bible who wanted to find out when all this stuff was really written. Not what people, when people said it was, but when it really was. And they've used that on Buddhist texts. And they found that things like that flower sermon by Mahakashyapa, that was much, much later than the earliest form of Buddhism, which was in the Chinese Agamas and in the Sutras. So you can have an objective way of finding which was real Buddhism spoken by the Buddha, which came later. So if you want to find that out, there's a whole book by written by Professor A.K. Warder called Indian Buddhism a long time ago, but it's a classic. He said, look, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm like a referee, an umpire. But this is the question I'm asking. What did the Buddha really teach, and what was added afterwards, and why it was added afterwards? And it's a great scholastic but very wonderful investigation. Now, using linguistic analysis and other analysis, historical analysis, to find out what was really early Buddhism. And that was much later. Ajahn. Now, this is a very profound question. It means that someone has got no meditation, they've been thinking too much and drinking too much coffee. Does a plant that eats animals do bad karma? I'm stumped. Why did the Buddha still ask questions for other people when he already knows their answers? Actually, it's only for confirmation that it will create the sutra in the Dhamma. I remember just sometimes that people would ask a question of Ajahn Chah. They already knew the answer, but because they really wanted other people to know the answer. So that's why if you write a question, you already know the answer, but you really want the teacher to talk about it, then write the question out. So you're doing that for the compassion and kindness of others. How do we know a person is an arahant or not? Heard that only the Buddha himself can recognize them. Yeah, that's true, but how do we know a person is an arahant or not? You don't. And it's one of our rules. We can't tell you who's an arahant or not. And the reason behind that is well illustrated by this story. Again, a young monk in Wat Pa Phong. I'd just gone there. The food was disgusting and terrible every day. Rotten fish curry, snails. They never like eating. I don't know if you've seen these erasers you used to rub out pencil marks. That's what the snails were like eating a rubber eraser. And, you know, terrible consistency. And just all this other stuff you eat. Anything which crawled on the ground, the first thing I was told, don't ask what's in the curry. I was actually told that, you know, by the monks. Don't ask, because otherwise, you know, it's bad enough eating it, but knowing what you're eating, that's worse. But every now and again, we get some people who came from the town, you know, from Ubon, the city, to actually give us food. And that was actually, you know, edible. I wouldn't say it was delicious, but you could eat it. And so one day, we were sitting there, you know, just facing just the rotten fish curry again and frogs. And a car pulled up, you know, like a pickup truck. And in the back was full of pots and pans. The person who brought this food to offer to Dana. Like all these people come and offer food to you. So they came with lots of pots and pans in the back. And straight away, like a young man, I'm going to get a good meal today. So you're really happy. And the guy came out of the cab and came into the dining hall where we're all sitting waiting and said, is Ajahn Chah here? That day he'd gone to a house for a blessing Dana. So they said no. So he got in his car and drove away. That wasn't funny, that hurts. And the reason is because, look, if you give food to an arahat, you get more bang for your bucks. You get heaps more karma. Now why invest it in sort of like in the Greek economy when you can invest it in somewhere like Australia? It's obvious. So because of that people would only usually give food to arahats, or people thought to be arahats, and no one else. And so that's one of the reasons why we never say. Because if we said, you know, that sort of, this monk was an arahat but I wasn't, that'd be it. You wouldn't feed me anymore. You'd feed him. So that's why we don't say at all, so that all the monks are even, and all the nuns are even as well. So that means you don't know who the arahat is, so you better feed a lot of us. Which is the most heavy in terms of karma? Doing something wrong, e.g. stealing, and know that it's wrong, but don't do it anyway, e.g. because we're scared, etc. Doing something wrong and don't know that it's wrong, doing something wrong with the intention to hurt somebody. That's obviously what's the most heavy, because karma intention is the most important part of karma. So if you do something wrong because you're scared to do it, or because you don't know it's wrong, there's nowhere near as heavy as it. Know it's wrong, I'm going to hurt someone, I'm going to re-hurt you. That's obviously wrong karma, bad karma, because that's the intention there. It's really nasty. But remember, it's intention that is the most important thing. So for example, you know, if you see a fly landing on Bhikkhuni Kusuma's head, and you know, you pick up sort of something and bang it, you know, just to scare the fly off, then your intention was pure. So it's no bad karma, although it would really hurt, so don't do it. Can someone be reborn as a bacteria or virus or worm inside a human body? Are they counted as beings in the 31 realms? Yeah, you can. No, well, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, maybe you can, because that's one of my favourite stories in the Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's a great story. So I'm going to tell it now, even though many of you have read it. And that's that there was the two monks. And these two monks were best of friends, and they practiced together. And after they died, one got reborn in the heaven realm. They're floating around, peace and joy, really wonderful time. But after, you know, enjoying the heaven realm for a while, he wondered where his friend was. Because, you know, they were so close together. And so he, in heaven realms, in the devas, they got psychic powers. So he searched his heaven realm looking for his friend, could find him nowhere. So he searched in the heaven realms above, couldn't find him there either. In the heaven realms below, couldn't find him. Nowhere in heaven could this friend be found. So he thought, I wonder what's happened to him. He said, I know. He's been reborn as a human being. Because that's a very fortunate birth. He said, he's been reborn straight away as a human being. So he searched the human realm, couldn't find his friend there either. He said, oh my goodness, he hasn't been reborn as an animal, has he? Searched the animal realm, no trace. Surely not as one of the creepy crawlies. And there he found his friend. His friend must have done some very, very bad karma, which he didn't know about. Because his friend had been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. And so, what do you do if you find a friend in trouble? You obviously try and help them. So this very refined heavenly being appeared in front of this pile of stinking shit and called out to his friend, hey worm, come out, do you remember me? In our previous life we were great friends together. And this little worm poked up and said, really? He said, yes. And the heavenly being said, I've been reborn in this beautiful heaven realm. You've been reborn in this pile of shit. You come with me, I can take you up there. And the worm said, hang on a moment. In this heaven realm of yours, is there any cow shit? And he said, no, of course not, it's heaven. And a worm said, no cow shit, I'm not going. I said, why? Well, cow shit's my home. It's warm and fragrant and it's delicious. Try some. Because to a worm in a pile of dung, that's its food, that's its home, and it's fragrant. And the heavenly being said, no, it's much better than cow shit. He said, come with me. And the worm wouldn't go. And so the heavenly being, he thought, if I could only show this worm what heaven is like, he'd obviously realize it's much better than being born in a pile of shit. So he grabbed the worm with the intention of taking up to heaven. But of course, the worm didn't want to go. And the worms in shit, they're covered with all this slime. He wriggled and wriggled, and he was so slippy, he got away from the heavenly being's grasp and went right into the center of the pile of dung to hide. But you don't give up on a friend that easy. Imagine just this refined heavenly being put his hand in the cow shit to try and find his friend. That's what compassion can do. And he found his friend and he pulled him out. But the friend, the old worm in the pile of dung, kept on wriggling and shouting and complaining, and every time he escaped because he didn't want to go. Many, many times The heavenly being tried to pull out his friend from the pile of ship, but the friend never wanted to go. And in the end, the heavenly being had to go to heaven and leave his friend to his pile of shit. For the last 7 days, I've been trying to pull you out of your pile of shit. But you don't want to go! Every time I almost get you out, you wriggle away. Why? Because it's nice, my shit. It's my food, and it's fragrant, and it's warm, and nice. That's why I like that story.
That's what attachment is like.
You can be attached like that worm to a pile of shit. What are you attached to? Can you please explain what a yakka is? A yakka is this ugly, terrible being. It's where we get the English word yucky from. What exactly is a naga? A naga is one of the dragons who breathes fire and stuff. And is it a dragon or a deva? It's basically a dragon, but there's nice nagas. Like even in the time of, in Western mythology, some of the dragons in Western mythology were very nice and very kind beings. Some were nasty beings. So just like you, some are really nasty beings, some are nice beings, it's like human beings. So yeah, that's what yakas are and that's what devas are. Does animals like crocodile or lion do bad karma all the time because they kill other animals for their food? It seems unfair since they can't be vegetarian. Crocodiles and lions do bad karma all the time. That's because it's really no intention, that's their instinct. Maybe they don't do such bad karma. So, is it unfair since they can't be vegetarian? I know that you can get these, we had the other day, some vegetarian meat, vegetarian sausages. So maybe the lions can get the vegetarian sausages. What's it called, like fake meat? What's it called again? Mock meat, yeah. Get mock meat for the crocodiles and lions. Maybe give the lions the five precepts. And the crocodiles, you think the crocodiles can keep the 5 feet? They've got such a big mouth. Very hard for them to keep noble silence. I don't know, anyway. Is it true that there is a certain creature beings that has 7 days being happy, like in heaven, and spend the next 7 days suffering, or goes on like that every 7 days? If yes, why is that? Yes, that's you. You have 9 days of happiness when you're here, then 9 days of suffering when you go back. No, I don't know about that animal. Heard that Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva sweared not to be enlightened until all the beings be from suffering. Is it possible this can happen? Apparently there's many bodhisattvas like that. There's Avalokiteshvara, there's Manjushri. Who else is there? And I once thought that at the end of time, when everyone else has been enlightened, there'll be this great traffic jam. Because Avalokiteshvara would say, look, I vow to be the last, so Manjushri, you go first. He said, no, I also vow to be the last, so you have to go first. No, says Kuan Yin, I was going to be the last, so you have to go. No, look, you cannot vow not to be enlightened. If you do, you're still Putuchana, you're still unenlightened, you haven't understood what the Buddha was talking about. There's no such thing about control and desire and wanting and stuff. This is a natural path. You've got no choice. It's not about you. And anyway, what's the most compassionate thing to do for the world? Is to become enlightened. Let's give a simile of a doctor. Suppose you were in medical school and you vowed not to graduate. So instead of actually taking all the time of these very professional doctors, these top doctors, instead of taking all these resources, that instead of actually staying at university and graduating, you can go and work right now and do operations out of compassion for other beings. Obviously that's a very stupid medical student, because you need to know all the skills before you can operate. Who would you like to operate on you? A medical student or a professor? I know who I would like. So who would you like to teach you Dhamma? An unenlightened bodhisattva, they put off their enlightenment, or someone who's been enlightened? Who would you prefer? It's obvious you have to graduate first before you teach. So that's why the arahats are far more powerful. And they don't waste their time, because just like the Buddha, for 45 years the Buddha taught. And in those 45 years created so many more arahats, enlightened beings. And they taught, and they created more arahats. That's the way this teaching has continued on. Arahats being created, and for so many years they live, and then they pass away, they never come back again. But in that time, from their enlightenment to their passing away, they are so powerful, they create so many more teachers. Just like the professor, once they've graduated and learnt a lot, then they go to university and teach others. And then they retire, they teach no more. But in the time they've been teaching at university, the professors create so many more professors. And that's why there's always plenty of professors to teach in universities. That's actually how the wheel of the Dhamma is always kept rolling. The arahats, they push it and then they fall away. They sort of die. Parinibbana, and other arahats keep pushing it. Always taking turns, one after the other. When a Christian kills a chicken to be eaten because they thought chickens are supposed to be our food, is the fruit of karma lessened? If a Buddhist who knows the five precepts kills a chicken? Or what happens if you know the chicken? Is that even worse? I remember my father saying that just after the Second World War, he was living in the suburb of Fulham, and to save a bit of money, you know, he started raising chickens with his brother, my uncle. And they had about three or four or five chickens. And when it came time to kill them, neither of them would do it. Because they're the pets. And eventually that they managed to kill one chicken. And they couldn't kill anymore. So all this great idea of raising chickens for food, they ended up with just four pets they had to feed and waste more money. So yeah, it is. Again, it's the intention that's the most important. And part of that intention is the knowledge whether it's right or wrong. With the suffering and pain caused by the killing of animals, a higher life form of plants for human consumption, shouldn't Buddhist monks out of compassion be vegetarian? Where is the middle of the path? If it's possible, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes I tried to be vegetarian here in Australia for a long time, and I really gave up once, and it was just the last time I really tried. Because I went to a house dana. This is when people come and feed the monks. And you can't, because we can't choose. It's what people bring us. That's all that we eat. So if I was choosing my food and buying it from the supermarket, cooking it myself, I would be a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. But because you just can't choose what food you get, you have some choice what you bring, but some of that I can't eat. So if you bought and cooked your own food, fine. But as a monk, as a bhikkhuni, because of that lack of choice, it's very, very difficult. So I went to this house, and this lady, I couldn't believe it. I was a vegetarian at the time, and she cooked, it was rice. And everything else was every different type of meat you could imagine. Now, there was chops, there was sausages, there was steaks, there was all different types of meat. Baked meat, roast meat, fried meat. And that was all it was. Just meat, 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 and meat. And rice. So I just ate rice. And I really sort of disappointed that lady. Because now she went to all this trouble and I wouldn't eat the food. And after that I thought, I just can't keep this rule anymore. So that's when I gave it up. So you try being a monk or a bhikkhuni, and then you'll understand why that we can't really keep vegetarian food. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have heard and read in one of the sutras that if a person does not answer when the Buddha asks him for three times, a person's head is going to be chopped into seven pieces by the deva. Is it so? Why are the devas so evil to have the heart of doing that? Nah, that's in the myth, because ask the Buddha three times. Now, I think that's one of those sort of myths, because it never actually happened. Do you remember it ever happened when the head split into seven pieces? I think it just means they're going to get a big headache. I feel very, very, very depressed ever since you said you would not consider going through another 20 to 25 rebirths. Please, please, please reconsider. Come on. I feel very depressed. Okay, that's your karma. Nothing to do with me. Can you please explain away the apparent contradiction between letting go of control of thinking mind and present moment awareness? How does one discourage flights of fantasy and detours into the past and future without some level of control? Now, this is, that's a good question, because in the present moment, that is letting go of control, because you lose the past and the future. How can you control when there's no future to aim at? Because all controlling is wanting something next. Wanting to get rid of this so you can get something else. It always includes perceptions of the future. If you really get into the present moment, there's no time, there's no future. So how can you want anything? So really going very deeply into the present moment stops control. It's a form of letting go. To control, you have to have some perception of the next moment, or 5 minutes or tomorrow. Something to aim at, something to do. This moment is already here. How can you control it? It's here. It's only to try and change it for something else, future. To want something else, future. So if you really get right into the present moment, you lose all control. It doesn't have any meaning anymore. So that's actually how you do it. And all these flights of fantasy, you're just going into the future again with flights of fantasy, what you want to get, where you want to go. I don't have to say this, but I want to. You're not only the great meditation teacher, you're also a great psychologist. Sadhu times three. I deserve that. Very good. It is believed that Deva Mara Putra, the god Mara, has struck meditators. Did you experience anything with Mara? How you overcome? Please explain what the Deva Mara is. Is it really a person or a Deva? It is both, but the most important thing about Mara is the controller. So, you know, it's a principle, but also a being. And you can actually see it inside of yourself. That principle of always wanting and to control it, that is Mara. And always promising, you know, all those fantasies you have of being the hero, saving the world, doing something wonderful for people, you know, becoming the prime minister of a president of Indonesia, all that sort of stuff. And that's Mara getting into your head and thinking that you can do better than all these other people. I've known a few presidents in my life, and they start off with really good intentions, but the system just makes them corrupt. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the system of, you know, getting into power is a stupid thing. That is one of the reasons why, just before the Buddha passed away, they asked him, who's going to take over once you're gone? And the Buddha said, no one will take over. No one will be the leader. The teachings and the training, that will be your leader after I've gone. Such a brilliant answer. So because of that, there is no Pope, no Ayatollah, no Archbishop in Buddhism. So it makes it very hard. Many monks especially try to exert their power. But, you know, it's against the Vinaya, it's against the Dhamma. You can't do that. Every monastery is independent. Every bhikkhuni, every bhikkhu is independent. It's our Vinaya, the teachings. That's actually our teacher. That's our boss, not a person. There is no abbots. There is no senior boss monks or boss nuns. There's no spiritual dictators. Not directors, spiritual dictators of the Buddhist society. I was called that once. You're not the spiritual director. And you're not the assistant spiritual dictator either, Venerable Nirodha. You're just the monks. And because of that, that means that there is no power game. That's actually how we overcome Mara. But you can see that, you know, in Sri Lanka you've got all these Mahanayakas. The Mahanayaka of this and the Mahanayaka of that. And the Sangharajas and all this sort of stuff. That's nothing to do with Buddhism. Because the Buddha saw that that's where Mara lives, in controlling others. Anyway, when I will be about 50 years old, I would like to become a monk. Would it be too late? Haven't you heard? Next year the world's going to end, 2012. So you better be a monk or a nun now. Well, you've got the chance. Can you please explain again short breath and long breath? That's an idiot. That's a question. Because I usually breathe in short lengths. I feel I need to control if I want to extend the breath. Is it necessary? No, it's not necessary. Breathe in naturally. Whatever your breath happens to be, that's good enough. You mentioned about pauses in break. It should be done. Pause in, pause out is above correct. Yes. You've got a little diagram over there. There's a pause between the in-breath and the out-breath, and a pause between the out-breath and the in-breath. Keep it naturally. Don't make a pause. Just see what happens. Your job is to observe, not to control. And what I was saying is to make it interesting. See which one is longest. The pause between the in-breath and the out-breath, or the out-breath and the in-breath. Why in Buddha's time so many people be Sotapanna, Arahat, easy, but now it's really, really rare. Is there any Arahat in this modern world? Look, if I really told you, whoever wrote this question, that everyone else in this room is an Arahat, only you aren't. You'd be really fed up, wouldn't you? You'd be really upset. That's why I don't tell you. Of course it's easy. You just have to follow the path. The trouble these days is people don't like following the path. It's so simple, the Eightfold Path. Keep it simple. But you know, instead of the Eightfold Path, we get into all this other stuff which people do, you know, just in the short path and Vipassana, Samatha, Jhanas, Dzogchen, and Mahamudras, and the fast path, the long path, the middle path, the short path. Look, the Eightfold Path is basic Buddhism. And that's why, that's what the Buddha taught, that's the way to enlightenment. And if you practice the Eightfold Path, then you get there. But we make things far too complicated. And that's one of the reasons. We read all these books, we learn all these talks. Somebody told me this, they're hearing this all, they've got 500 of my talks on an iPod. My goodness, that's far too many. Just Eightfold Path, that's all you need on your iPod. That's one of the reasons why we don't get enlightened. Spend too much time listening to the Dharma and not practicing it. Basically. Is it okay to combine stage 1 and 2 with stage 3 and to establish present moment awareness by watching the breath? It seems easy to focus on the breath and on nothing. If I shouldn't combine them, on what should I focus during stage 1 to be able to stay in the present? Yeah, if that happens naturally, the breath comes up, fine, just watch the breath. But the most important thing is the present moment aspect of the breath. You can see many, many things. You can look at me and see my size, see my colour, you know, see the smile. There's many aspects of every experience. So if you're watching the present moment, the very fact that this is happening right now is your main object. It's nowness. So yeah, you're doing present moment awareness, but you're not so much watching the breath, the fact is happening now. And that way you establish present moment awareness. And then you're watching the breath, but the most important thing you're watching, there's no commentary with the breath, you're silent. So whatever object you're watching, it's the fact it's in the present moment, or the fact it's silent, that's really important. And then you can do it with the breath, to do it with anything. Please explain about free choice. Do we really have free choice? No, you don't. Whoever wrote that, you had no choice, you had to write this question. That's really weird, isn't it? I once had an argument with someone who said that we have free choice. I said, the free choice we have is conditioned, not determined. I did not have enough info to support my view. Can you explain? Exactly, you are totally right. But when he argued with you, he had no choice but to argue. So don't blame him. So I have really great fun with that. You know, when so we're getting to the no choice and the no will argument, you have really fun. So they say, why did you do this? I got no choice. If I had no choice, that means I can do whatever I want. I can do bad things. I said, no, you can't. You've got no choice. You have to do good things. It really gets people confused. That's really great fun. But look, you all know, ask all the monks and nuns, anatta, there's no one in there. There is no self. You all know that's in the teachings. You hear that again and again and again. So if there is no self, where does this will of yours come from? It can't come from you, because there's no one in there. So it must come from conditioning, that's the only option. And that's perfectly correct. You think it's you, but it ain't. This Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, you can get his work on YouTube. He did this amazing experiment. You know, when you actually do something, and he was having people, his experimenters, just flex the palm of their hand. That's all. But they did that randomly. And when they actually formed the will to move their hand, with the other hand they pressed a button. Now I'm going to move. At the same time, he had some gizmo on their brain, because before you move, there's something they call the readiness potential in their brain. And you can actually see that on these MRI scans. So he wanted to find out, this readiness potential, does that appear after you make the choice, or rather after you are aware of choice, or does it appear before or after? And what he actually found, this thing we call will, the thing which you recognize as you are choosing, happens after the readiness potential. In other words, there's something forms in the brain, and then in the process of doing something, you have this experience, which you take to be the will. That's what you recognize as will. That's what you take to be your will. But it's not the initiator of the action. By the time you will something, it's inevitable. It's part of the process, it's not the beginning of the process. And that was actually fascinating research. Proved exactly what the Buddha said. This thing you take to be your choice and will, it is an illusion. You recognize that because you associate this thing you call choice with the action which follows afterwards. But the delusion is that you think it initiates the action. It doesn't. It's part of the process. The action has already been initiated. By the time you recognize will, you can't stop it. It's not free will at all. Every psychologist or physiologist knows that. It's just part of the process, which is conditioned. You have no choice. Isn't it wonderful? So you're totally conditioned. And I mentioned to many of you, for the last 6 days, I have been conditioning you, brainwashing you. And I say that quite honestly. Some of you are very resistant. You have to be brainwashed every retreat, but one day I'll get through. Since Amazon's Kindle e-books have become very popular and easy to use, do you plan to publish all your books in Kindle format? I know some of the books are already in e-books. But remember what that Zen monk said. Books, books, books. Kindles, Kindles, Kindles. Too many, too many, too many. Recycling bin, recycling bin, recycling bin. Chinese poems. 10,000 flowers in spring. Which means lots of hay fever for monks like me. The moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. It's not Australia. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. The last one is okay. So it's not clouded, but actually I don't agree with that. It's not your mind. My mind doesn't belong to me. If it's your mind, it always gets clouded with unnecessary things. Because it's my mind, that's why I attract things. That's why it's called mine field. Get blown up all the time and suffer. Terrible joke, but it's almost 9:30. So what do you expect this time of night? Is the breath a reflection of the knower as it refines and becomes delightful? The knower also becomes stronger. No, the breath is not a reflection of the knower, but the refinement of it is the reflection of your stillness. The more still, the more refined. If someone is taking advantage of you and doing something to harm you, how can you be assertive and kind at the same time? Yeah, you're always taking advantage of me. Always asking me questions. Always. But I like you. So that's how you are kind. Let them take advantage of you. I am here to serve. And you say that to other people. I'm here for you to take advantage of. Why not? You're not in there anyway, so you've got nothing to lose. But if they really are harming you, then being assertive is actually making sure it's being kind so they don't make bad karma. So, you know, someone's trying to hurt me. It's really bad karma to hurt me. So I've got to run away fast. Out of compassion for them, that is. Could you please tell a story of the noise only the monks can hear? The noise only the monks can hear. Oh, that one. That's a good one to finish off with. Like psychic powers. Weird stuff. Because you know there's very weird stuff goes on in the world. And this was a story. It was of this Australian guy. I haven't told this for a long time. This Australian guy, he was trekking in Ladakh. You know, that's in the Himalaya Mountains. And I don't know if any of you have been up there. It's really a beautiful scenery. So he was on this trek with a group of other people. And, you know, because he was with his, got his cameras photographing this and photographing that, he got separated from the main group. And he tried to catch up, but he took the wrong turn and got lost. So there was this Australian guy, lost in the Himalaya Mountains, and wandering around, getting really, really cold. It's very, very dangerous. And fortunately, just before it got too dark to see, he saw the lights in the distance. So he obviously made a beeline for those lights, managed to get there. It was a Buddhist monastery. And Buddhist monasteries are always very hospitable. So, you know, he got in there, and they took him to the abbey and said, look, I'm sorry, I was on this trek and I got lost. And the abbey said, never mind, I know those trekkers. I know where they go, so we can take you to the place to meet up with them tomorrow, but tonight you can actually rest with us. And because he was a laundry lay person, they gave him something to eat. They gave him a nice room. And he really thanked the abbot, and so he went to sleep in the monastery. But he woke up in the middle of the night, just past midnight, because he heard this sound. It was just the most amazing, beautiful noise he'd ever heard in his whole life. You know, he'd been to sort of, you know, listen to the Berlin Philharmonic and learn to all these amazing sort of maestros. And this was 100 times more beautiful than any music he'd ever heard before. And it was, he wondered what it was, but it calmed him, it inspired him so much. But when it finished, he just went into this very deep and peaceful sleep. He was woken up in the morning by the monks. He had his breakfast, he had to leave early to catch up with the rest of the group. And he said goodbye to the abbot and thanked him so much for giving him hospitality. He left a little donation. But as he left, he asked the abbot, he said, look, last night I heard this amazing sound. It's so beautiful. What was it? And at that, the abbot said, oh, that I can't tell you. Only monks can know what that sound is. And the Australian said, look, you know, I'm going soon. I'll never become a monk. You can tell me what it was. He said, no, that's our rule. That's our law. We can't tell you. Okay, said the Australian. He got out his wallet. How much? And the other said, no, I'm not looking for donations. You know, I can't tell you. You have to be a monk to know what that sound is. And no matter how much the Australian argued, so the abbot wouldn't give in. And he had to leave to catch up with his party. So eventually he had to leave without finding the answer and got back to his party, continued the trek, had a wonderful time. But he couldn't get that sound out of his head. When he got back to Australia, to Sydney, he just was getting so obsessed with this sound, he had to go see psychologists. He was, no, because people get obsessed with all sorts of things. And he couldn't sleep at night, and he was so worried about it. And in the end, 1 year later, he went back to Ladakh. He was driving him crazy, this sound. So he went to see the abbot and said, look, you remember me, I was here a year ago, and I heard that incredible sound. I have to know what it was. And the abbot said, look, sir, I remember you, and I told you last time. I can't tell you what it is because you're not a monk. The Australian said, exactly, ordain me as a monk. I have to find out. He said, you mean you're going to become a monk just to find out that sound? Yes, I'm crazy otherwise. And the abbot said, look, you know, it takes a couple of years before you become a monk. I don't care how long it takes. I'm going mad. So the abbot said, okay. So he got him into the monastery and started the training of being a monk. You know, 1 year as an anagarika, doing all the services for the monastery, another year as a novice. 2 long years. You know, he'd sacrificed 2 years of his life so he could find out what the sound was. And eventually his ordination day came. He ordained. And of course, as soon as he was a full monk, he asked the abbot, now, please tell me, what was that sound? And the abbot said, look, I can tell you now. Actually, I'll do better than that. I'll show you. This evening, come to my room, just before midnight. So, you know, what had obsessed him and worried him and lost his sleep for 3 years, this evening he was going to find out what the answer was, what this incredible, most beautiful sound was. So he was at the abbot's office about 11:30 and waiting. And just before midnight, the abbot said, come with me. And he pushed aside a curtain at the back of his office, and underneath, behind that curtain, was this ancient wooden door. Because some of these monasteries, you know, in that part of the world, have been there for many, many centuries. And you wouldn't believe some of the things which are in those ancient monasteries. And he got out this bunch of keys from his desk. And the first key on it was this wooden key, which he used for the wooden door. And as he pulled it open, it creaked, you know, like old doors do. And as soon as it was open, the music began. It was incredible. And the guy was actually crying with bliss. It was that amazing. It was really thrilling. He can't resist it. It's the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard. But he couldn't see the source yet because it was a corridor. And he saw at the end of the corridor there was another door, a big iron door. And of course the abbot had to get out the iron key and turn that. And of course as soon as they opened the iron door and went closer in, the music became clearer, louder, and just more thrilling. It was just really almost impossible to listen to without, you know, falling down in bliss. It was something supernatural, way beyond anything people can hear in this world. They walked to the end of the corridor and there was another door there, made of solid silver. And he had a key which matched it, the silver key. And he opened that door. And of course the music became clearer and more blissful, more bliss than he'd ever heard. And he saw at the end of the corridor there was the last door, the golden door. And as they approached, he noticed that golden door was encrusted with jewels, worth a fortune. Whatever was at the other side of that door was something so amazing, so precious. They had this priceless golden door studded with jewels to hide it. And before he got out the golden key to open the last door, the abbot looked at this guy from Australia and said, "Are you ready? Because, you know, this has not been seen by many people. It's only monks. Are you really prepared?" And he was serious. You know, you've all been scared sometimes when you get into these deep meditations. This was that 100 times magnified. And so the Australian, even though he'd waited 3 years for this, really thought, because this was serious stuff. He said, "Look, I have to find out. Doesn't matter what it does to me. I have to know." "Okay," said the abbot, "brace yourself." And the abbot put the golden key in the door and pulled it open. And there, this guy from Australia, just being ordained as a monk, saw it. You know what it was? "I can't tell you because you're not monks." So good night, everybody. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.